Hello, hello, and welcome back, or welcome to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm your host, Yogi Roth, and we are in the middle of season three. Have had a variety of really fun conversations. Got a bonus podcast already this week. We talked to Jared Blank, who literally, by the time you listen to this podcast, he will have begun leg one of the World Marathon Challenge. Make sure you listen to that conversation. Leg one is in Nova, Antarctica, by the way. So yeah, he's going to do seven marathons on seven continents. Oh, in 7 days. So yeah, season three, we are rolling. Now today's guest, I am jacked about. He is going to impact you in a lot of ways. His name is John Heyman. Now, John is a phenomenal guy. He's the CEO of this company called One World Play Project. Now, this company, they literally do one thing better than anybody in the globe, which is bring the power of play to millions of people. Now, I met this company randomly. I did an interview on the Jim Rome Show. I talked about the power of play. I had recently finished filming a documentary. You can check it out on YouTube or yogiroth.com, titled We All Speak Ball, which is about American football in Israel. I went over to Israel, interviewed a bunch of people, went to games, had a blast. Someone from their company heard the conversation I had with Jim Rome, randomly sent me a note and said, hey, let's talk. Once I heard what this company was doing, I was like, I gotta get involved. And I am. So what does this company do? Well, they literally give away this soccer ball that is the most resilient ball on earth. You can check it out online. Just Google One World Play Project ball. People have tried to run over this ball, pop this ball, shoot this ball with a gun. I mean, you can't pop this ball. It's the most resilient ball. So I partner with them to give away the ball to people who have resilient stories. So the idea is I'm a storytelling ambassador for One World Play Project, and I am seeking resilient stories of individuals, teams, communities, and I'm going to go there, have a conversation, do an interview, and give you the most resilient ball on earth. I've already given a couple away. One was to Cade Spinello. If you don't know his story, just Google him or check his feature out at yogiroth.com or at pack-12.com. It's a feature of an amazing young resilient man who's beaten cancer. Clearly defines what resiliency is all about. But when you look at this company, One World Play Project, their mission, it's amazing. It's literally to bring the power of play to youth and adults around the world. Because play, as we all know, is a fundamental human need. There's science that has proven that. There's studies that have proven that. Is that when you play, your life changes. And I've seen it in a variety of different countries when I can't speak the language, don't know anybody, and roll out a ball or start playing catch, all of a sudden you tear down walls. And that's what this company has done. This ball is in over 185 countries. 2.2 million balls as of today have been given away. An estimated about 60 million people have played with one of these soccer balls, really impacting all over the globe. Now, John is the CEO of this company, and his story is fascinating. Number one, he saw the beauty in this when this company got going in 2010. As a CEO, has been responsible for major deals, getting this ball into more communities than probably anybody imagined when they began. And then his personal path is one that I think a lot of us will lean into. At 42 years old, he and his wife decided they wanted to give back, and they joined the Peace Corps. I mean, imagine doing that at 22. We could probably do that, but imagine doing it at 42. That's just a small sliver and element of his story. So anyway, I urge you to really sit down, get grounded with this one. It's going to force you to definitely want to play, but also, and almost more importantly, get involved with this. With every ball that you purchase at oneworldplayproject.com, they give a ball away to somebody in a refugee community, and their impact in refugees in Syria, Greece, Italy, the USA, and beyond. And as the son of a refugee, this brand, this company, this ball really impacted me in a large way. And we're going to make sure we take care of you. You can go to their website, and when you order a ball, use the code YOGI, Y-O-G-I. It's in the title of the podcast, and you'll get a special 20% discount if you want to purchase a One World football for yourselves. And of course, then we'll give one away to someone else, or you can buy them for other people, and we'll continue to give these balls away and impact the world through the power of play. Because as John says so eloquently in our conversation, he says, quote, we only exist to have impact. This is John Heyman, the CEO of the One World Play Project, a company that I'm so proud and excited and enthused about being a small part of as a storytelling ambassador. This one is going to remind you that the power of play is real. And regardless of whatever language you speak, religion you believe in, or political party you align with, there is a fundamental truth. We all speak ball. Enjoy. And we're at the headquarters, right here, One World Play Project with the CEO. John, thanks for joining me, man.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I love it. So this podcast is all about exploring what it means to be human. And when I was able to partner with the company that you're running right now, when I look at a ball, to me, there's an element of being human. I think we all want to play. I think it's something innate in us. It's why when you're a baby, you play with the box more than the Christmas gift. And there's a childlike fascination to that. So I want to ask you, before we dive into your story and everything you're doing here, what your relationship is with the word play.
What a great question to start with. We think of play here as social nutrition. And so it's something that feeds us, and it's something that all human beings need. It's like what we need for cognitive development. It's what we need for even happiness, you know, just sort of the basics of happiness. And so play is an integral part of everything that we do. And I personally think of play as being a very broad spectrum of things. It's everything from having a sense of humor to art to music to football to any kind of recreational thing that you're doing. I mean, hiking is a form of play. And so it's something that we need to have in our lives all the time. So that's a kind of the social nutrition piece. It's maybe a little bit lower down on the Maslow's hierarchy, but it's pretty important.
When was the first time you got exposed to play?
Probably before my memory started. So what's my first memory of play? I think I remember a sledding trip once where the neighborhood kids were going down what seemed like a really steep hill at the time, but was probably, you know, like a 1% grade. And it was so exhilarating. I could still feel the exhilaration of racing down that hill with my friends all around me. And I think in some ways, to me, play is still about being with friends and doing things in groups.
Where was that?
It was outside of Washington, D.C., on a very snowy slope. And I would date myself if I tell you what year it was. But, this one, when kids still had these little flexible flyers, they were called, was the sled.
Wow. All right. So I want to stay on that. We'll get into the job that you do here as the CEO. Why do you think, because if I ask you right now, tell me your last 10 emails, you might be able to remember one of them, two of them, I would imagine. But if I said, give me 10 moments where play really lit you up, mm-hmm. whether it was riding the sled or going to a Cal Bears game, why do you think it's so easy to get back in touch with those types of moments?
Because there's so much joy around play. There's not so much joy around email.
Well said. That's a t-shirt.
So, yeah, maybe that's a t-shirt. But you're right. I mean, I could tell you 10 stories from as far back as when I was, 3-4 years old about moments when play really lit me up. And some of them would be like last weekend. So it's an ongoing thing.
Okay, so when this idea about a ball, buy one, maybe give one. Like, how did this whole thing happen? Because you are on the ground floor of a company now who's given millions of balls away to people around the world trying to spark these unique moments of play where they get connected to the moments you just eloquently described.
Yeah, so the creation story is really pretty interesting. And the credit goes to Tim Jonigan and his wife, Lisa, who really were the ones who conceived of the project. And Tim was watching a documentary, a CNN documentary about Darfuri refugees. And this was, maybe 8-9 years ago. And he saw kids in the refugee camp playing with a ball that was made out of trash, basically. It was plastic bags. It was string. It was anything that they could find to turn into a ball because they had such an incredible desire, drive to play that in the midst of all this squalor, they were playing. They found a way to play. And so Tim had been playing around with a material called EVA foam, ethyl vinyl acetate foam, and he didn't really have a use for it yet, but he was, he's a very creative guy, and he was exploring the world. He saw this documentary, and he thought to himself, surely somebody could make a ball, maybe me, that would stand up to those conditions. And he said, I wonder if this material would work. So it started his thinking process going. At the time, he was also one of the producers of Sting's Rainforest concerts. So he was with Sting one day, and Sting was talking about soccer and how he wanted to build soccer pitches all over the world. And Tim said something like, you know, I've got this idea for a ball that if I could just figure out how to fund it, I could get it made. And Sting said, that's an amazing idea. I'll pay for it. And so that's how the project got started. Sting was actually our first investor. He put up the seed money for the engineering, I guess. And that took a while to get it right. It actually turns out to be pretty hard to make something round out of this material or any others. But you've seen the end product. I mean, it's this amazing ball that never goes flat. It doesn't need a pump. You can stab it with a knife. You can run it over with a truck, and it just keeps on playing.
That's fascinating. Okay, so here's this guy who has this idea around this amazing concept of play and how he's going to create the most resilient ball of all time. In comes Sting after it's set in front of hundreds of thousands of people on when he went on tour, and they decide to partner. When do you get a call, and when do you get brought into the journey here?
So once the ball was pretty far into development, Tim and Lisa started realizing that that they needed to have a vehicle for how they were going to get it out into the world. That it wasn't just, you know, if you build it, they will come. You have to actually do something about it. And they didn't really have a clear business model for it. So my work at the time was working with all kinds of social impact organizations, both for-profit and not-for-profit, to help them figure out how to make the world a better place. So they asked me if I would help them with a business plan. So I put together their original business plan, and I sat in on all of the early meetings about should we be for-profit, should we be not-for-profit, and some really kind of deep, interesting questions. And I became an advisor to them.
When you become an advisor, you know, we all get asked to advise our friends on companies. And we give them a phone call, maybe a couple cups of coffee. But some of those ideas grab you. You know, when did this one grab you? Was it hard? Was it easy? Because this isn't an easy gig that you have. I mean, you're every day competing to allow more people the opportunity to play. I'm curious for you when the light went on for you of, okay, yeah, I want to support you, but no, now I need to be involved in this thing.
I look back on it, I think it took me about, 15, 30 seconds to go, wait a minute, this is really something. Because I get pitched all the time on, you know, please help me with this business plan. I've got an idea to set the world on fire, you know, yada, yada. And I go, not so much. This one, it just grabbed me immediately. I mean, just the thought of an ultra durable ball that could bring play to places where there's no opportunity for play. It just set something off in my brain. And so very early on, I did start out sort of doing it pro bono. And then at some point, they started compensating me for doing that on a very small basis. But I was hooked from the moment I heard about the idea.
When was the first time you saw somebody playing with this One World Play Project ball?
We had a really early model of the ball. It doesn't look like the ball does today. It had a different pattern on it. It was softer. It bounced a little bit more. And I think we had it was a local giving trip where we gave them away to a low-income community somewhere in the San Francisco Bay Area. And you just watch the faces of these kids light up when they get this ball and they realize what it is. And they see you, like, you step on it and it goes completely flat and then it bounces back into shape and their jaws drop. And it was, so it had to have been, you know, within the first few months of having the balls being produced.
When this thing started to go, what was that like? Because all of a sudden this went from an idea to collaboration to whoa. And it wasn't just because of Sting. It was because clearly you built something that's unique and special and taps into something organic.
So we're still figuring out how to build it, actually. The model is a really interesting one. I like to say that, you know, we're a for-profit business, but we don't want to have profit without impact. So we're a mission-based business. We only exist to have impact. So we need profitability in order to have impact, but we don't want to have profitability without impact. So the two things are totally connected. So our model is a little weird. We make money by giving stuff away.
Karma. That's the karma model right there.
It's the karma model, but you know, karma doesn't always equate to cash. And so we're constantly playing with the model of how we make that work. But to answer your question, we went from 0 to 60 in about 6 months. I mean, it was really bizarre because we got a contract with General Motors very early on in our existence. That was originally a 3-year contract that GM essentially paid for 1.5 million balls that we distributed all over the world for them. And so they were branded balls. So unlike most startups, we had a customer and we had revenue, but we were a startup. We were, you know, like 4 or 5 people, and we had to all of a sudden figure out how to distribute 46,000 balls a month all over the world. And so we built up this amazing giving network of 50,000 partners that we now have that do the giving on the ground for us, and we distribute to them. So we're now in 185 countries, and we've distributed to date about 2.2 million balls, impacting about 60 million people.
I mean, yeah, just let those numbers sink in for a second, right? I mean, that's amazing when you think about. And what I love, an analogy that I was told, one of my mentors, his name's Pete Carroll, head coach of the Seahawks, NorCal guy. And he told me this story, God, probably 12 years ago. He said, if I walked into a gymnasium with 10 guys and I rolled out 5 basketballs, there'd be a bunch of guys just shooting hoops, all these random hoops. He goes, but I rolled out 1 basketball, it'd be 5-on-5, and it'd be incredible competition, and you'd have friendships, you'd have games, you'd have energy, maybe some fans would come, you'd come back again. And the big reason I leaned into this when I first got a call from members of your staff was, wow, if you roll one ball out to a community of 20, whether it's in East Africa or East LA, you're going to see that transformative power sport happen. So when I hear the number 2.x million balls, I think 20 million people. Like, I think so many people's feet and heads have touched that ball.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you know, really, when you think about it, there's a double multiplier effect, because first of all, we figure on average 20 to 30 people play with each ball, because we don't give them to individuals. We give them away to schools, to orphanages, to, you know, to organizations that are using soccer or football in their programmatic delivery. So we've given them to organizations that do everything from, you know, gender equity to conflict resolution to we even have one partner that uses it to teach math skills. So, you know, the kids are so engaged in play that they don't even realize that they're dribbling from point A to point B and adding those two numbers together and then doing something else, you know, with dribbling the ball to another point to find the multiplier. And so they're teaching math skills with it. So there's the multiplier effect from that standpoint. But also, for a lot of these organizations, our, you know, 40 or 50,000 giving partners, they go through massive numbers of standard soccer balls, because they're, for a lot of them, they're being used in pretty harsh conditions. So, you know, think thorns, barbed wire, glass, rock. The average life expectancy of a soccer ball, the standard soccer ball in the developing world, is about 20 minutes. So they get it out on the field, they play with it for a few minutes, it hits a thorn, game over. Mm. With our ball, we've got balls that have been out in the field so long that they've worn off the logo and the raised marks, but the ball still plays. We've gotten pictures of balls back that are completely punctured with 1,000 holes, and they still play. So the multiplier effect is more than just how many kids touch it. It's the amount of time that they have to play with it.
Have you talked to, you know, psychologists around what play can do for people when they, you know, are living in harsh and difficult environments?
There's a lot of information about play and, you know, scientific study of the kind of cognitive development and play's role in cognitive development and what it means, you know, especially when kids are at a certain age. Play has such an oversized impact on their ability to develop cognitively that it's going to have long-term impacts on their, you know, all of their abilities, reading, writing, math, interactions, social interactions. All of that stuff is formed early, and play helps with all that stuff.
Okay, so you have this partnership with GM, things rolling, you got this company going. One of the things that stood out to me as the son of a refugee was when I went on your website and I'm thinking sports, ball, play, and then I see refugees and I watch these videos. How do you get involved with refugee communities? What are you guys doing with refugee communities around the power of play? Because not only is that a hot topic, but that's a hot reality around the globe right now.
Yeah, so, you know, I think we think of the refugee situation as being more than just refugees. We think about displaced people everywhere in the world. And it's a growing global crisis, you know, like over 60 million people right now displaced. And that number is growing all the time. And they're not just displaced by war. They're displaced by famine, by drought, by stupid politicians, you know, by drugs. There's all kinds of reasons why people are displaced. And, you know, you think about it. You lose your identity. You may not have a passport, so you can't travel because there's nobody that recognizes your status. You may be living in a camp that doesn't have any kind of services. You may have a cell phone, but no internet connection. You may not have electricity. And so it's pretty grim. And what breaks that stress is play. And so we're working with partners that are doing a number of different things. Some of our partners are working directly in refugee camps in places like Syria. Others are working with people who have been displaced but have been moved to other countries like Italy or the U.S. or Greece that are accepting refugees in. And in those cases, what play does and what our ball does is it brings together the refugee community with the local community, which may be looking at those refugees or those displaced people with some suspicion. And they find a common thread. The common thread is play. It doesn't matter. You know, when you think about soccer, think about a ball. A ball is a round thing. In and of itself, it's nothing fancy. But it doesn't require an instruction book, and it doesn't require any kind of interpretation. You can use it in any language. You can use it at any age. So I was at a business conference recently, and I brought a ball with me. I take one with me everywhere. And there are all these people sitting around in a circle, you know, wearing business suits and all looking very, very grim and very proper. And I put the ball on the floor next to me and I just leave it there. And within a couple of minutes, the person next to me looks down. They start to play with it. They kick it to the person next to them who kicks it across the room. And pretty soon this whole group of people in suits are playing with the ball.
Wow.
That's, I mean, to me, that says it all.
It's fascinating. What have you seen? Or what have you heard from refugee communities? And I ask that because my whole life I thought up until I was probably 32, 36 now, that my mom was an immigrant. And then she told me one day after we watched Fiddler on the Roof, that my brother was an actor in, and we're walking down the street after the play, and she was crying at the end of the film. I said, or at the end of the play, I said, Mom, why are you crying? And she goes, well, at the final scene, you see these kids carrying their bags and they're going to this refugee camp. She goes, that was me. And she spent 2 years in Germany at a refugee camp at 6 years old. And she remembers vividly everything about that. So, of course, that's what I think of when I hear about this ball and going to these displaced communities about, okay, I don't know if you're necessarily fenced in, but you're in a community that's pretty, I don't know, whether it's tied in or wherever you may be. Like what a ball can do. And now all of a sudden I think of her and there isn't a fence anymore, right? There's a field and it's a stadium and there's fans around you. Have you heard things like that when you guys have worked with these displaced communities?
All the time. And it's, you know, I laugh about this, but my wife and I, when we want to reconnect with the mission, which is every week, we take our laptop, we put it on the dining room table, we get a box of Kleenex and we watch some of the videos that we have online of the people who are using the balls that we've donated. And it never fails. I mean, it goes right to your heart because here are people often living in really tough conditions who are there while they're playing, they're completely uplifted. They're completely out of whatever those tough conditions are. Whatever stress they were feeling around their circumstances is gone for the moment. And that's what play does.
Wow. I think a lot of people that are listening right now you're clearly inspired, right? You're 18 minutes in. You're like, whoa, this is awesome. I want to be involved. Now, when you say the numbers like 2.1, 2, 3 million balls, people are like, well, that's kind of an intimidating number. Mm-hmm. How can people not necessarily, we're going to get to how do you get involved with this project, but you're a guy who also worked with the Peace Corps. Now, how easy is it to put your hand out and open it up and say, hey, I want to give part of myself to you know, communities or individuals or areas of the world that are struggling?
You know, I think this is a basic, anybody who's conscious as a human being is thinking about how they can give back. And, you know, it's a completely individual thing. Everybody gives in their own way. But it's amazing to me how our culture, in this country anyway, is changing so much towards people being more cognizant, more aware, more involved in wanting to do something with purpose in their lives. And I don't know if that's because, you know, so much of the work that people do these days is kind of without a big chunk of purpose. And so they're looking for it in other places. And these kinds of projects, you know, they resonate with people because it's a one-to-one kind of thing. Yes, we've given away 2.2 million balls, but I connect with the individuals that we've given those balls to because I see them all the time. My wife and I were traveling in East Africa last year, and we were just on a random country road in Rwanda, you know, like 2 hours outside of the capital. And we're driving down the road, and we see a kid playing with our ball. And we know it's our ball because it's a very distinctive color, and it wasn't flat. And the ball was clearly used. I mean, it was dirty, and it had holes in it. And here we were in the middle of Rwanda watching this kid play with our ball. I mean, how can you not connect with that?
Yeah, jeez. Does that light you up? Of course it lights you up as an individual, and you're watching those videos with your wife, or you're on the streets in East Africa. And I've been to Rwanda, and I totally can imagine that scene right now. But when you come into this chair and you got to develop a strategy and a mission and make sure you have impact, that's got to make your job purposefully driven. And you don't have to be a millennial to be purposeful, right? You've been doing it your entire existence, but I'm curious how that transforms into you coming in here and now being the CEO and having to strategize.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'll be completely straight about that. It's hard to both run a business and keep your eye on impact, because there, you know, oftentimes it seems like those two things are in opposition to each other. In the case of One World Play Project, they're so integral to everything that we do. You know, we have three strategic pillars that we base all of our decision making on, and they are profitability, impact, and innovation. And those three things are sort of at the core of everything that we do strategically. That's not to say that we don't have to run a successful business. We do. We have to figure out how to make it be sustainable and viable, deliver a product that people want and are willing to pay for so that we can give it away. And so there are all the day-to-day challenges of that. But for instance, we start off all of our team meetings with what we call mission moments, where before we get into any of the business of the day, we go around the table and people share what their interactions were with the mission, with impact. And people tell stories. They say, you know, I got a call the other day from this woman, and she saw her ball for the first time, and she just flipped out because, you know, she saw her kids are into soccer, and, you know, and the stories just go on and on and on. Or we heard from a partner who's running a refugee program in Italy, and they told us that they were having the toughest time getting the local community to connect with the refugees who are in their midst. And then we rolled out the footballs, and all of a sudden, everyone's playing together, and they're all talking to each other, and now they're going out to the bar together, you know, to have a drink afterwards. So we try to keep in touch with our impact and our mission through things like that, at the same time that we're working on making it a performing business.
I went to Israel last February and did a short film called We All Speak Ball. And it was how American football was in the Middle East. And it was Palestinians, Jews, Christians, Protestants. It didn't matter. Men, women, all different ages, all different colors from all over the globe playing American football, sold out like it was Texas high school football on Friday nights. And I've always believed that the power of play is so real, and the phrase "we all speak ball" is legitimate, right? I don't need to speak Yiddish or English or Spanish or French, but I can speak how to compete. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen any moments where like the ball has created like some crazy competitive moments? Because those are great as an athlete. You love those things. I'm curious if it when people play, you know, they're getting after it too.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, because I can think of two examples that are at sort of the opposite ends of the scale from each other. So one is I've seen in Rwanda, for instance, Hutus and Tutsis playing ball together, right? And they're just like, we're just playing ball. And I've seen Shias and Sunnis playing ball together because it's like we're just playing ball. When I was in Peace Corps, I was in Costa Rica in Central America, and there was a pickup game that was going on in the backyard of the people who live next to our host family when we were first in training. And of course, they're playing soccer, right? They're playing football because that's what they do. And so I'm the old guy. I was in my 40s when I joined Peace Corps, so I was like already middle age. But I played soccer in high school, and I played a little semi-pro after high school. And so, you know, I think I can still play. So they say, you know, hey, Juan, you want to play? And so I said, yeah, sure, I can play. And they all think I'm going to be just lousy. You know, I'm just this gringo, right, who's coming in. And the first time I touched the ball, I scored a goal. And their kind of opinion of me changed 180 degrees in that 1 second, and then it got really competitive.
Okay, this is amazing. All right, Peace Corps. I read your bio. I'm doing my prep. I'm Googling you. I didn't know you were 40.
Yeah, 42.
42 when mm-hmm. you joined the Peace Corps. Okay, there's a lot of people listening to this that are trying to figure out their life, and they're probably 22, just finishing college, or they're at a point in transition. Maybe they got fired for the first time, and they're 30, or they're at a pivot point in their life. Maybe they got divorced. Maybe they got laid off, and they're in their late 40s, early 50s. It's happening all across the sport landscape, from Nike to ESPN and so on and so forth, unfortunately. What made you pivot to go to the Peace Corps at that age?
Well, you know, for me, I was a woodworker after college. I did an apprenticeship with an old German millwright and learned how to be a woodworker.
Where?
In D.C.
Okay.
And, you know, I was in my early 20s, and I was pretty arrogant. And, you know, after a couple of years of apprenticeship, I figured I knew everything there was to know about business and woodworking and everything. So I started my own company, and I grew that, and I bought another company, and I grew that. And so at that point I had like 50 people working for me, and, you know, we were doing this really high end millwork. Our clients were the architect of the Capitol and the White House and, you know, the Smithsonian and places like that. So, and it was a really crappy business. I mean, it was hard and the customers were nasty, and I learned a lot about what I didn't want to have in business, but I was burning out. I was working 18-hour days. And so I came home from a business trip, and I said to my wife, you know, I think I'm going to sell the business. I need to change. I need to do something different, because it was just driving me crazy. And she's very wise, so she didn't say anything. She didn't argue with me. She didn't say yes. She didn't say anything. She just went quiet. But she started thinking about it. And the next day, she said, so have you thought about what you want to do after you sell the business? And I said, no, I really haven't given it any thought. And she said, well, I think we ought to join the Peace Corps. And as soon as the words came out of her mouth, I went, oh, my God, that's the right answer for us. Right in this moment, that's exactly the right answer. I needed something that was a complete reset that just took me out of, I was living in D.C., I was a yuppie, you know, I was spending money on stuff that I shouldn't have been spending money on, and it was all hollow. There was no meaning to any of it. And Peace Corps was like that complete reset for me. So it wouldn't be for everyone, but for us, it was like the most amazing life-changing experience. It was a complete reset.
All right, we're diving into this a little more. Okay, so explain everybody.
We're supposed to be talking about play.
100%. Okay. Well, you're fine. Like, to me, when I hear that, the way I'm piecing it together in my mind is that you are going through this life, this existence, to you, to use your words, hollow. I wonder at that point how much play was in your life. Like, how much pickup hoops were you playing? Mm-hmm. You know, were you ever having those moments of exuberance that now you see in the streets of Rwanda, you have in your board meetings before you start? Like, I'm imagining no.
I had one very small thing that I did that I carved out space for myself, and it was only because my wife insisted on it, and that was horseback riding.
Okay.
So there was a stables right near us in D.C., in Rock Creek Park, and I would kind of dressage and jumping lessons for about 6 months. And then I just went out in Rock Creek Park and rode, and it was my catharsis. It was, you know, when you're on a horse, it's like being on a bicycle or something. You know, you're just focused on what you're doing. You're focused on your balance. You're focused on the animal. You're focused on the ride, and the world goes away. That was my play, and that's what kept me sane.
And how often were you doing that?
Once a week.
Okay, so once a week. So you go from once a week, horseback riding throughout, you know, the countryside, to you're going to go do the Peace Corps. Now, my understanding of the Peace Corps is there's no take backs. You know, like when you go, like you're gone for, it's a commitment, right?
You're sounding like my mother.
Yeah.
When I told her, we waited until we were like almost on the plane. And she said, no, you can't go. I said, what do you mean I can't go? I said, I'm not asking for permission. I'm telling you what I'm going to do. And she said, well, what if you don't like it? And I said, well, it's not the Army. You know, I mean, it's not like they lock you up. But yeah, it's a 2-year commitment. And we ended up being there for almost 2.5 years because they asked us to stay on to finish up a project.
And they don't, my understanding is you don't pick, right? They kind of, once you sign up, hey, I want to go to the Peace Corps, they say, okay, you're going here.
Yes, except we were a little bit older and we had really strong skills around, you know, small business and things like that. So we had a little bit more latitude. We wanted to go to a Spanish-speaking country. And okay. So we sort of held out for that.
All right, so you drop into Costa Rica, which was not nearly the hot spot that it is now.
No.
I just imagine a lot of play occurring there. I'm curious for you, was there an early moment or a later moment in your 2+ years there where play became, again, a guiding light for you?
There's so many little flashes of you know, what play was. We had to do 3 months of training before we swore in as volunteers. And so we were with a group of about 30 or 40 people who all arrived in country at the same time. And they were all ages from, you know, as young as 22 up to about 60. And when we had breaks from our training, people would go play. It was like recess in school, right? And I can remember one particular soccer game. There was a soccer field on the campus, on the training campus. And I can remember one particular game where there was a young woman there who lives in Berkeley now, by the way, who got the ball and she was dribbling toward the goal. And she was so happy and so excited, she just started laughing. She just started laughing. And I can still picture her dribbling up the field laughing her head off out of joy, out of sheer joy. The truth is that so much of Peace Corps was what I now think of as play, even though it was really serious stuff. But it was like I had to learn how to speak Spanish. That's kind of a form of play, learning a new language. It's like, you know, playing a musical instrument. That's a kind of play. There was the interaction. There were no telephones. No one had a telephone. There weren't cell phones then. There wasn't even the internet. I mean, Google hadn't been really invented yet. This was the late 90s. Google was around, but it wasn't a phenomenon. It's hard to believe that's only 20 years ago. But anyway, I digress. Staying in touch with other volunteers across the whole country without telephones, without cell phones, without internet was a game. It was a game. There was like these jungle drums that would happen. All of those things are a kind of play, that social interaction.
I'm curious your take on this. When we're kids, we're signed up for every sport, or we're playing it on our own, pending our socioeconomic living status, wherever we are in the world. When we get into high school, we play if we're good, or if we want to be part of a team. We're in college, we have to be gifted as an athlete to compete on that stage. Very few of us get to play as pros. And then we go and work out because it's fitness, and we're supposed to go to the gym and burn X amount of calories a day. And play becomes this thing that we had so much joy as a child, because that's what we did. You went outside and you played. And then it becomes almost like a chore as you get older, because you're like, I just got to go run hoop for 45, man, or go play pickup soccer just to get my heart moving. Curious your take on that, because of maybe some of the friends that saw you in your early 40s go to Costa Rica and then come back, and now you're running this company around the simple concept of a ball. Have you seen it shift some ideals? And why do you think it can potentially remain that way of, you know, play is only for something when you're younger?
You know, I think this comes down to a personal consciousness around the role of play. And, you know, I can only speak for myself. I don't know how other people really relate to it. I can see what other people do. But, you know, I was one of those people who, you know, I felt like I really should go to the gym. You know, my exercise is walking my dog in the park, right, for an hour. But a couple of years ago, my wife and I bought a stationary bicycle, right? And we keep it in the library and we ride it. You know, it's boring. I mean, it's just boring. And I'm getting exercise, but it's just boring. And so like a month ago, we went out and we bought e-bikes. And e-bikes are great because, you know, when you get older, you can't ride as hard or as far as you used to be able to. but you're still riding. And the first time I got on one, it was like being that kid again. It was like I remembered in excruciating detail the thrill of being mobile, of being able to move faster than I could walk, of having the wind in my face, of being able to turn a corner, of being able to ride with no hands. All of that stuff came back to me on that bike in a way that would never happen on the stationary bike. So one is exercise and one is play. And we kind of sometimes we confuse those two things, and they're not the same. I mean, some people get joyful from exercise, and it's just they're oxygenated, I guess. I don't get joyful from exercise. I get joyful from play. And if I can put the two together, so much better.
How do you hope that your wife defines you, assuming she's the person that knows you the best?
Wow, that's a deep question. Well, I hope she thinks that I'm a genuine person. I know she thinks I have a good sense of humor, although she groans at it from time to time. But that's how I know that she thinks I have a good sense of humor. And, you know, I mean, I would hope almost anyone who knows me would think this, that I'm trying to give back more than I'm taking. And that's sort of a central part of who I am and who I want to be.
I ask that question not to get personal, because when you say genuine, fun, right, laughter,
yeah,
and give, I believe in sport, athletes are a direct reflection of their coach. And I think this brand is a direct reflection of its CEO. Mm. And now as somebody who's a part of this brand on a small scale, but as a story ambassador for you guys, I love hearing that, man, because you're giving. And I think we're meant on this world to give everything away. I mean, nothing's in your wallet when you're done. You know, give it and give it and give it till you got nothing left to give, and you don't want anything in return. Now, karma will work. But that's why I ask you that. So as we kind of wrap here for the next couple minutes, I want to know, amid all these experiences, from sledding to Costa Rica to running this company, when you heard about it from day one, what makes you feel most alive?
In the context of the business?
In the context of you. Because I think learning your story, this is our first 40 minutes together.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't see a difference between One World Play Project and your path.
So, I mean, I think that this is what a lot of people are aspiring for, but they haven't identified it. That it seems a real shame to me. I was going to say criminal. I won't go that hard. But it seems a real shame to me when people have to have one set of values at work and another set of values at home. And so, you know, this whole notion of having a social venture is so that you can have the same values that you have at home in the work that you do. And, I mean, I think that's what we try to do here. And I mean, I'm glad you think that I'm a good reflection or a good, you know, brand ambassador. But I think the coach analogy is a lot better, because we have an amazing team here. And I don't get credit for the brand. You know, I mean, I'm stewarding it, but I don't get credit for it. The credit goes to the people who figured out the idea in the first place and the team that's actually brought us this far. And I'm kind of the coach who makes all the moving pieces work together. But it's that, why would we have different set of values for one circumstance and a different set? Those aren't values, as far as I'm concerned. Value is non-negotiable.
So within that, what makes you feel most alive among this group and this community and the work that you're doing?
I think it's learning new things. You know, before we started, I said I'm still learning. Every day is a learning experience. I think it's stretching, and it's teaching makes me feel really alive. I just love to be able to share whatever I've learned along the way with people who are having different perspectives or are looking at life from a different angle.
I love that. You know, this is the first time I've ever interviewed somebody around an organization that I'm involved in. I'm a rookie. You know, I just joined the squad. Coach me up. Where can I make sure, as a story ambassador for you guys, I can have the biggest impact to create and continue to sustain and evolve the power play?
Well, first of all, you may be a rookie, but you get play. And that's, you know, I often have to start off explaining play and explaining the value of play. You clearly and totally get that. I mean, I've looked at your stuff, and, you know, you've got some great material that we're going to steal some of it, by the way. And I hope you steal some of ours. You know, anybody who's looking to have some impact, especially if they're oriented around sport and they understand what sports can do for people, for their development, for their happiness, for their, you know, for their joy. We have all kinds of ways to get involved in what we're doing. And my hope is that, you know, I said we've distributed something like 2.2 million balls. We haven't even scratched the surface of need. If you look at the global population, we have somewhere between 1.5 and 2 billion people living in poverty at some level or another. And not that our ball is only for people in poverty, but that's where we're going to get the big impact. And so, you know, I said we've maybe impacted 60 million out of 1.5 billion. So we could do a couple hundred million balls and still only be scratching the surface, 10, 15%. And so, as I said, our model is we need people to get involved to help fund the manufacture of these balls so we can give them away. We know how to give them away. We've got contacts all over the world. We've got so much need. People are calling us every day saying, how can I get more balls? How can I get some balls? Can you ship balls to this country or that country? So anybody who wants to get involved, we have campaigns that people can do for small amounts. We're looking for partners. You know, I mentioned GM is a partner. We did a partnership with Hilton Hotels to distribute balls for a new brand that they have. We're looking for at all kinds of, you know, corporate partnerships. We have partners who are just buying the balls outright and giving them away in their home communities. All of those things help because they're impact. The impact is what we get from moving the balls.
How can people get involved? It's the easiest way.
Go to our website. There's options for doing a campaign. There are options for partnerships. There are options for buying an individual ball or giving an individual ball. It's all on oneworldplayproject.com.
I love that. All right, so before I let you go, we ask everybody these final two questions. Curious how you feel about the word limits. The word limits, when you hear that word.
I feel very limited by that. You want me to expand on that,
go wherever
that
you
snarky
want.
Answer?
Yeah, we can go wherever you want.
I think when I hear the word limits, I think about the limits we put on ourselves in our thinking. We often just get stuck in our routine of how we see the world. And I think my experiences have been kind of consciousness expanding because I've put myself into positions where I had to adapt to a new culture or a new way of thinking about things. And that has a tendency to break down our own barriers, the things that limit us personally. And that's scary stuff. You know, I think I would say that there's an awful lot of fear about the future. And that's because it's ambiguous. We can't know what the future is going to bring. We limit our thinking when we think it can only look like what we know right now. And so my way of dealing with the ambiguity of the future is to say, yeah, I don't know what the future is going to look like, but I know that when it comes, I'll figure out how to get it, how to get through it.
Okay, so from a kid in D.C. on the sleigh ride, having a blast, to running and gunning as a professional, spending money on things that maybe shouldn't have been spending money on, to the Peace Corps in Costa Rica, before anybody knew Costa Rica was a hot Instagram spot, to now, as the CEO of one of the most unique brands in play, impacting people all across the globe, what do you seek? What type of life are you seeking now at this stage with this ball and your involvement in an amazing community of employees and ambassadors around the globe?
So personally, what I'm seeking is what my next reinvention is going to be. I think I'll always be involved with this organization because I just love it so much. But I also feel like I've in some ways accomplished what I set out to accomplish 2 years ago when I first came on board. And it was always meant to be, I'll help you pop to the next level. And then we have some amazing people here who are ready to take on more responsibility. So I'm thinking about how to grow the impact of what One World is doing. And I'm also thinking about what my next reinvention is going to be.
I love that. John, this has been a blast. I'm really honored to be a part of the team. And my goal on this team is I want to take the most resilient ball that I've ever seen. I've been around sport since I came into this earth and find the most resilient individuals and communities and hopefully give them a simple ball to go play with. And if I could do that, man, then this organization has been amazing.
Well, I think just knowing what I know about you, I think you're going to be a great fit here. And what I would want to say to you is, let's have some fun.
Yeah, baby. I love it.
How about that? That was one of the most fun conversations I've had in all of season 3, as well as season 2 and season 1. I mean, you want to talk about dedicating elements of your life to the power play and then doing it. And of course, for all of us listening, we can get involved because play, I mean, it's a basic human need. I mean, science would say, I touched upon it in the open, that it's critical to the healthy, physical, social, emotional development of children, adults, especially those living in disadvantaged communities. And I truly believe this, that everyone should have the access to play, right? We hear about it from our parents all the time in our hometowns. Not enough kids are running around playing ball anymore. And that may be true because there's a lot of other things going on. But the power of play and what it can teach us and how it can serve as something that could literally save our lives or teach us elements to utilize in our lives is real. So go to oneworldplayproject.com. Use the discount code YOGI, all caps, YOGI. Get 20% off. Buy a ball. Give a ball. Let us give one to a community in need all over the globe. And of course, if you have a story about somebody resilient, let me know. I'm going to find them and I'm going to give them a ball myself. Thanks for listening. Much love. And as always, you know how we end this thing. The only limits we have in life are the ones we set ourselves.